Windsor. This opened the door to city-contracted tow truck operators patrolling the neighborhood like sharks on Sunday morning. Any cars without the proper resident sticker on the windshield were fair game. They got towed. Which finally brings us to Jason Jessup, our suspect.
He drove a tow truck, I said.
Exactly. He was a driver for a city contractor named Aardvark Towing. Cute name. Got them to the front of the listings in the phone book, back when people still used phone books.
I glanced at Bosch and could tell by his reaction that he was somebody who still used the phone book instead of the internet. Maggie didn't notice and continued.
On the morning in question, Jessup was working the Hancock Park patrol. At the Landy house, the family happened to be putting a pool in the backyard. Kensington Landy was a musician who scored films and was doing quite well at the time, so they were putting in a pool, and there was a large open hole and giant piles of dirt in the backyard. The parents didn't want the girls playing back there, thought it was dangerous. Plus, on this morning, the girls were in their church dresses. The house has a large front yard. The stepfather told the girls to play outside for a few minutes before the family was planning to go off to church themselves. The older one, Sarah, was told to watch over Melissa.
Did they go to Trinity United? I asked.
No, they went to Sacred Heart in Beverly Hills. Anyway, the kids were only out there about 15 minutes. Mother was still upstairs getting ready, and the stepfather, who was also supposed to be keeping an eye on the girls, was watching television inside. An overnight sports report on ESPN or whatever they had back then. He forgot about the girls.
Bosch shook his head, and I knew exactly how he felt. It was not in judgment of the father, but in understanding of how it could have happened, and in the dread of any parent who knows how a small mistake could be so costly.
At some point, he heard screaming, Maggie continued. He ran out the front door and found the older girl, Sarah, in the yard. She was screaming that a man took Melissa. The stepfather ran up the street looking for her, but there was no sign. Like that, she was gone.
My ex-wife stopped there for a moment to compose herself. Everyone in the room had a young daughter and could understand the shearing of life that happened at that moment for every person in the Landy family. Police were called, and the response was quick, she continued. This was Hancock Park, after all. The first bulletins were out in a matter of minutes. Detectives were dispatched right away.
So this whole thing went down in broad daylight? Bosch asked.
Maggie nodded. It happened about 10:40. The Landys were going to an 11 o'clock service.
And nobody else saw this?
You gotta remember, this was Hancock Park. A lot of tall hedges, a lot of walls, a lot of privacy. People there are good at keeping the world out. Nobody saw anything. Nobody heard anything until Sarah started screaming, and by then it was too late.
Was there a wall or a hedge at the Landy house?
6-foot hedges down the north and south property lines, but not on the street side. It was theorized at the time that Jessup drove by in his tow truck and saw the girl alone in the yard. Then he acted impulsively.
We sat in silence for a few moments as we thought about the wrenching serendipity of fate. A tow truck goes by a house. The driver sees a girl, alone and vulnerable. All in a moment he figures he can grab her and get away with it.
So, Bosch finally said, how did they get him?
The responding detectives were on the scene in less than an hour. The lead was named Doral Kloster, and his partner was Chad Steiner. I checked. Steiner is dead, and Kloster is retired and has late-stage Alzheimer's. He's no use to us now.
Damn, Bosch said.
Anyway, they got there quickly and moved quickly. They interviewed Sarah, and she described the abductor as being dressed like a garbage man. Further questioning revealed this to mean that he was wearing dirty coveralls, like the city garbage crews used. She said she heard the garbage truck in the street, but couldn't see it through a bush where she had hidden from her sister during a game of hide-and-seek. Problem is that it was a Sunday. There was no garbage pickup on Sundays. But the stepfather hears this and puts it together, mentions the tow trucks that run up and down the street on Sunday mornings. That becomes their best lead. The detectives get the list of city contractors, and they start visiting tow yards. There were 3 contractors who worked the Wilshire corridor. One of them is Aardvark, where they go and are told they have 3 trucks working in the field. The drivers are called in, and Jessup is one of them. The other 2 guys are named Derek Wilburn and William Clinton.
Really? They're separated in question, but nothing comes up suspicious. They run him through the box, and Jessup and Clinton are clean, but Wilburn has an arrest but no conviction on an attempted rape 2 years before. That would be good enough to get him a ride downtown for a lineup, but the girl is still missing, and there's no time for formalities, no time to put together a lineup.
They probably took him back to the house, Bosch said. They had no choice. They had to keep things moving.
That's right, but Kloster knew he was on thin ice. He might get the girl to ID Wilburn, but then he'd lose it in court for being unduly suggestive. You know, is this the guy? So he did the next best thing he could. He took all three drivers in their overalls back to the Landy house. Each was a white man in his 20s. They all wore the company overalls. Kloster broke procedure for the sake of speed, hoping to have a chance to find the girl alive. Sarah Landy's bedroom was on the second floor in the front of the house. Kloster takes the girl up to her room and has her look out the window to the street, through the Venetian blinds. He radios his partner, who has the three guys get out of the two patrol cars and stand in the street. But Sarah doesn't ID Wilburn. She points to Jessup and says that's the guy. Maggie looked through the documents in front of her and checked an investigative chronology before continuing. The ID is made at 1 o'clock. That is really quick work. The girl's only been gone a little over 2 hours. They start sweating Jessup, but he doesn't give up a thing, denies it all. They are working on him and getting nowhere when the call comes in. A girl's body has been found in a dumpster behind the El Rey Theater on Wilshire. That was about 10 blocks from Windsor and the Landy House. Cause of death would later be determined to be manual strangulation. She was not raped, and there was no semen in the mouth or throat. Maggie stopped her summary there. She looked at Bosch, and then me, and solemnly nodded, giving the dead her moment. Chapter 6. Tuesday, February 16th, 4:48 p.m. Bosch liked watching her and listening to the way she talked. He could tell the case was already under her skin. Maggie McPherce. Of course that was what they called her. More important, it was what she thought about herself. He had been on the case with her for less than a week, but he understood this within the first hour of meeting her. She knew the secret, that it wasn't about code and procedure. It wasn't about jurisprudence and strategy. It was about taking that dark thing that you knew was out there in the world and bringing it inside, making it yours, forging it over an internal fire into something sharp and strong that you could hold in your hands and fight back with, relentlessly. Jessup asked for a lawyer and gave no further statement, McPherson said, continuing her summary. The case was initially built around the older sister's identification and evidence found in Jessup's tow truck. 3 strands of the victim's hair found in the seat crack. It was probably where he strangled her.
There was nothing on the girl? Bosch asked. Nothing from Jessup or the truck?
Nothing usable in court. The DNA was found on her dress while it was being examined 2 days later. It was actually the older girl's dress. The younger girl borrowed it that day. 1 small deposit of semen was found on the front hem. It was typed, but of course there was no DNA in criminal prosecutions back then. A blood type was determined and it was A positive, the second most popular type among humans, accounting for 34% of the population. Jessup matched, but all it did was include him in the suspect pool. The prosecutor decided not to introduce it at trial because it would have just given the defense the ability to point out to the jury that the donor pool was more than 1 million men in Los Angeles County alone. Bosch saw her throw another look at her ex-husband, as if he were responsible for the courtroom obfuscations of all defense attorneys everywhere. Harry was starting to get an idea about why their marriage didn't work out.
It's amazing how far we've come, Holler said. Now they make and break cases on the DNA alone.
Moving on, McPherson said. The prosecution had the hair evidence and the eyewitness. It also had opportunity. Jessup knew the neighborhood and was working there the morning of the murder. As far as motivation went, their backgrounding of Jessup produced a history of physical abuse by his father and psychopathic behavior. A lot of this came out on the record during the death penalty phase too, but, and I will say this before you jump on it, Holler, no criminal convictions.
And you said no sexual assault? Bosch asked.
No evidence of penetration or sexual assault, but this was no doubt a sexually motivated crime. The semen aside, it was a classic control crime. The perpetrator seizing momentary control in a world where he felt he controlled very little. He acted impulsively. At the time, the semen found on her dress was a piece of the same puzzle. It was theorized that he killed the girl and then masturbated, cleaning up after himself but leaving one small deposit of semen on the dress by mistake. The stain had the appearance of a transfer deposit. It wasn't a drop. It was a smear.
The hit we just got on the DNA helps explain that, Haller said.
Possibly, McPherson responded. But let's discuss new evidence later. Right now, I'm talking about what they had and what they knew in 1986.
Fine, go on.
That's it on the evidence, but not on the prosecution's case. 2 months before trial, they get a call from the guy who's in the cell next to Jessup at County.
He jailhouse snitches, Haller said, interrupting. Never met one who told the truth. Never met a prosecutor who didn't use him anyway.
Can I continue? McPherson asked indignantly.
Please do, Haller responded.
Felix Turner, a repeat drug offender who is in and out of County so often that they made him a jail orderly because he knew the day-to-day operations as well as the deputies. He delivered meals to inmates in high-power lockdown. He tells investigators that Jessup provided him with details that only the killer would know. He was interviewed, and he did indeed have details of the crime that were not made public, like that the victim's shoes were removed, that she was not sexually assaulted, that he had wiped himself off on her dress.
And so they believed him and made him the star witness, Haller said.
They believed him and put him on the stand at trial, not as a star witness, but his testimony was significant. Nevertheless, 4 years later, the Times comes out with a front-page exposé on Felix the Burner Turner, professional jailhouse snitch who had testified for the prosecution in 16 different cases over a 7-year period, garnering significant reductions in charges and jail time and other perks like private cells, good jobs, and large quantities of cigarettes.
Bosch remembered the scandal. It rocked the DA's office in the early 90s and resulted in changes in the use of jailhouse informants as trial witnesses. It was one of many black eyes local law enforcement suffered in the decade.
Turner was discredited in the newspaper investigation. It said he used a private investigator on the outside to gather information on crimes and then feed it to him. As you may remember, it changed how we used information that comes to us through the jails.
Not enough, Haller said. It didn't end the entire use of jailhouse snitches, and it should have.
Can we just focus on our case here? McPherson said,
obviously tired of Haller's posturing. Sure, Haller said. Let's focus.
Okay, well, by the time the Times came out with all of this, Jessup had long been convicted and was sitting in San Quentin. He, of course, launched an appeal citing police and prosecutorial misconduct. It went nowhere fast, with every appellate panel agreeing that while the use of Turner as a witness was egregious, his impact on the jury was not enough to have changed the verdict. The rest of the evidence was more than enough to convict.
And that was that, Haller said. They rubber-stamped it.
An interesting note is that Felix Turner was found murdered in West Hollywood a year after the Times exposé, McPherson said. The case was never solved.
Had it coming, as far as I'm concerned, Haller added. That brought a pause to the discussion.
Bosch used it to steer the meeting back to the evidence and to step in with some questions he'd been considering.
Is the hair evidence still available? Bosch asked. It took McPherson a moment to drop Felix Turner and go back to the evidence.
Yes, we still have it, she said. This case is 24 years old, but it was always under challenge. That's where Jessup and his jailhouse lawyering actually helped us. He was constantly filing writs and appeals, so the trial evidence was never destroyed. Of course, that eventually allowed him to get the DNA analysis off the swatch cut from the dress, but we still have all trial evidence and will be able to use it. He has claimed since day one that the hair in the truck was planted by the police.
I don't think his defense at retrial will be much different from what was presented at his first trial and in his appeals, Holler said. The girl made the wrong ID in a prejudicial setting, and from then on it was a rush to judgment. Facing a monumental lack of physical evidence, the police planted hair from the victim in his tow truck. It didn't play so well before a jury in 86, but that was before Rodney King and the riots in 92, the O.J. Simpson case, the Rampart scandal, and all the other controversies that have engulfed the police department since. It's probably going to play really well now. So what are our chances? Bosch asked. Holler looked across the table at McPherson before answering. Based on what we know so far, he said, I think I'd have a better chance if I were on the other side of the aisle on this one. Bosch saw McPherson's eyes grow dark. Well, then maybe you should cross back over. Holler shook his head. No, I made a deal. It may have been a bad deal, but I'm sticking to it. Besides, it's not often I get to be on the side of might and right. I could get used to that, even in a losing cause. He smiled at his ex-wife, but she didn't return the sentiment. What about the sister? Bosch asked. McPherson swung her gaze toward him. The witness? That's our second problem. If she's alive, then she's 37 now. Finding her is the problem. No help from the parents. Her real father died when she was 7. Her mother committed suicide on her sister's grave 3 years after the murder, and the stepfather drank himself into liver failure and died while waiting for a transplant 6 years ago. I had one of the investigators here do a quick rundown on her on the computer, and Sarah Landy's trail drops off in San Francisco about the same time her stepfather died. That same year, she also cleared a probation tale for a controlled substance conviction. Records show she's been married and divorced twice, arrested multiple times for drugs and petty crimes. And then, like I said, she dropped off the grid. She either died or cleaned up her act. Even if she changed names, her prints would have left a trail if she'd been popped again in the past 6 years. But there's nothing. I don't think we have much of a case if we don't have her, Holler said. We're going to need a real live person to point the finger across 24 years and say he did it. I agree, McPherson said. She's key. The jury will need to hear the woman tell them that as a girl she did not make a mistake, that she was sure then and she is sure now. If we can't find her and get her to do that, then we have the victim's hair to go with, and that's about it. They'll have the DNA, and that will trump everything. And we will go down in flames, Holler said. McPherson didn't respond, but she didn't have to. Don't worry, Bosch said. I'll find her. The two lawyers looked at him. It wasn't a time for empty rah-rah speeches. He meant it. If she's alive, he said, I'll find her. Good, Holler said. That'll be your first priority. Bosch took out his keychain and opened the small penknife attached to it. He used it to cut the red seal on the evidence box. He had no idea what would be in the box. The evidence that had been introduced at trial 24 years earlier was still in the possession of the DA's office. This box would contain other evidence that was gathered but not presented at trial. Bosch put on a set of latex gloves from his pocket and then opened the box. On top was a paper bag that contained the victim's dress. It was a surprise. He had assumed that the dress had been introduced at trial, if only for the sympathetic response it would get from the jurors. He lifted the dress out, holding it up by the shoulders. Opening the bag brought a musty smell to the room. All three of them were silent. Bosch was holding up a dress that a little girl had been wearing when she was murdered. It was blue, with a darker blue bow in the front. A 6-inch square had been cut out of the front hem, the location of the semen stain.
Why is this here? Bosch asked. Wouldn't they have presented this at trial?
Holler said nothing. McPherson leaned forward and looked closely at the dress as she considered a response. I think they didn't show it because of the cutout. Showing the dress would let the defense ask about the cutout. That would lead to the blood typing. The prosecution chose not to get into it during the presentation of the evidence. They probably relied on crime scene photos that showed the girl in the dress.
They left it to the defense to introduce it, and they never did.
Bosch folded the dress and put it down on the table. Also in the box was a pair of black patent leather shoes. They seemed very small and sad to him. There was also a second paper bag, which contained the victim's underwear and socks. An accompanying lab report stated that the items had been checked for bodily fluids, as well as hair and fiber evidence, but no such evidence had been found. At the bottom of the box was a plastic bag containing a silver necklace with a charm on it. He looked at it through the plastic and identified the figure on the charm as Winnie the Pooh. There was also a bag containing a bracelet of aqua blue beads on an elastic string.
"That's it," he said.
"We should have forensics take a fresh look at it all," McPherson said. "You never know. Technology has advanced quite a bit in 24 years.
"I'll get it done," Bosch said.
"By the way," McPherson asked, "where were the shoes found? They're not on the victim's feet in the crime scene photos."
Bosch looked at the property report that was taped to the inside of the box's top.
"According to this, they were found underneath the body. They must have come off in the truck, maybe when she was strangled. The killer threw them into the dumpster first, then dropped in her body."
The images conjured by the items in the box had brought a decidedly somber mood to the prosecution team. Bosch started to carefully return everything to the box. He put the envelope containing the necklace in last.
"How old was your daughter when she left Winnie the Pooh behind?" he asked.
Holler and McPherson looked at each other. Holler deferred.
5 or 6, McPherson said. "Why?"
"Mine too, I think. But this 12-year-old had it on her necklace? I wonder why."
"Maybe because of where it came from," Holler said. "Haley, our daughter, still wears a bracelet I got for her about 5 years ago.
McPherson looked at him as if challenging the assertion.
"Not all the time," Holler said quickly, "but on occasion. Sometimes when I pick her up. Maybe the necklace came from her real father before he died."
A low chime came from McPherson's computer, and she checked her email. She studied the screen for a few moments before speaking.
"This is from John Rivas, who handles afternoon arraignments in Department 100. Jessup's now got a criminal defense attorney, and John's working on getting Jessup on the docket for a bail hearing. He's coming over on the last bus from city jail."
"Who's the lawyer?" Holler asked.
"You'll love this. Clever Clive Royce is taking the case pro bono. It's a referral from the GJP.
Bosch knew the name. Royce was a high-profile guy who was a media darling who never missed a chance to stand in front of a camera and say all the things he wasn't allowed to say in court.
"Of course he's taking it pro bono," Holler said. "He'll make it up on the back end. Sound bites and headlines, that's all Clive cares about."
"I've never gone up against him," McPherson said. "I can't wait."
"Is Jessup actually on the docket?"
"Not yet, but Royce is talking to the clerk. Rivas wants to know if we want him to handle it. He'll oppose bail."
"No, we'll take it," Holler said. "Let's go."
McPherson closed her computer at the same time Bosch put the top back on the evidence box.
"You want to come?" Holler asked him. "Get a look at the enemy?" "I just spent 7 hours with him, remember?"
"I don't think he was talking about Jessup," McPherson said.
Bosch nodded. "No, I'll pass," he said. "I'm going to take this stuff over to SID and get to work on tracking down our witness. I'll let you know when I find her."
Chapter 7. Tuesday, February 16th, 5:30 p.m. Department 100 was the largest courtroom in the CCB and reserved for morning and evening arraignment court, the twin intake points of the local justice system. All those charged with crimes had to be brought before a judge within 24 hours, and in the CCB, this required a large courtroom with a large gallery section where the families and friends of the accused could sit. The courtroom was used for first appearances after arrest, when the loved ones were still naive about the lengthy, devastating, and difficult journey the defendant was embarking upon. At arraignment, it was not unusual to have mom, dad, wife, sister-in-law, aunt, uncle, and even a neighbor or two in the courtroom in a show of support for the defendant and outrage at his arrest. In another 18 months,
when the case would grind to a finale at sentencing, the defendant would be lucky to have even dear old mom still in attendance. The other side of the gate was usually just as crowded with lawyers of all stripes, grizzled veterans, bored public defenders, slick cartel reps, wary prosecutors, and media hounds all mingled in the well or stood against the glass partition surrounding the prisoner pen and whispered to their clients. Presiding over this anthill was Judge Malcolm Firestone, who sat with his head down and his sharp shoulders jutting up and closer to his ears with each passing year. His black robe gave them the appearance of folded wings, and the overall image was one of Firestone as a vulture, waiting impatiently to dine on the bloody detritus of the justice system. Firestone handled the evening arraignment docket, which started at 3 p.m. and went as far into the night as the list of detainees required. Consequently, he was a jurist who liked to keep things moving. You had to act fast in 100 or risk being run over and left behind. In here, justice was an assembly line with a conveyor belt that never stopped turning. Firestone wanted to get home. The lawyers wanted to get home. Everybody wanted to get home. I entered the courtroom with Maggie and immediately saw the cameras being set up in a 6-foot corral to the left side, across the courtroom from the glass pen that housed defendants brought in 6 at a time. Without the glare of spotlights this time, I saw my friend Styx setting the legs of the tool that provided his nickname, his tripod. He saw me and gave me a nod, and I returned it. Maggie tapped me on the arm and pointed toward a man seated at the prosecution table with 3 other lawyers. "That's Rivas on the end. Okay, you go talk to him while I check in with the clerk." "You don't have to check in, Holler. You're a prosecutor, remember?" "Oh, cool. I forgot." We headed over to the prosecution table, and Maggie introduced me to Rivas. The prosecutor was a baby lawyer, probably no more than a few years out of a top-ranked law school. My guess was that he was biding his time, playing office politics and waiting to make a move up the ladder and out of the hellhole of arraignment court. It didn't help that I had come from across the aisle to grab the golden ring of the office's current caseload. By his body language, I registered his wariness. I was at the wrong table. I was the fox in the henhouse, and I knew that before the hearing was over, I was going to confirm his suspicions. After the perfunctory handshake, I looked around for Clive Royce and found him seated against the railing, conferring with a young woman who was probably his associate. They were leaning toward each other, looking into an open folder with a thick sheaf of documents in it. I approached with my hand out. "Clive the Barrister Royce, how's it hanging, old chap?" He looked up, and a smile immediately creased his well-tanned face. Like a perfect gentleman, he stood up before accepting my hand. "Mickey, how are you? I'm sorry, it looks like we're going to be opposing counsel on this one." I knew he was sorry, but not too sorry. Royce had built his career on picking winners. He would not risk going pro bono and stepping into a heavy media case if he didn't think it would amount to free advertising and another victory. He was in it to win it, and behind the smile was a set of sharp teeth. "Me too, and I'm sure you'll make me regret the day I crossed the aisle." "Well, I guess we're both fulfilling our public duty, yes? You helping out the district attorney and me taking on Jessup on the cuff." Royce still carried an English accent, even though he had lived more than half his 50 years in the United States. It gave him an aura of culture and distinction that belied his practice of defending people accused of heinous crimes. He wore a 3-piece suit with a barely discernible chalk line in the gabardine. His bald pate was well tanned and smooth. His beard dyed black and groomed to the very last hair. "That's one way of looking at it," I said. "Oh, where are my manners? Mickey, this is my associate, Denise Graydon. She'll be assisting me in the defense of Mr. Jessup." Graydon stood up and shook my hand firmly. "Nice to meet you," I said. I looked around to see if Maggie was standing nearby and could be introduced, but she was huddled with Rivas at the prosecution table. "Well," I said to Royce, "did you get your client on the docket?" "I did, indeed. He'll be first in the group after this one. I've already gone back and visited, and we'll be ready to make a motion for bail.
I was wondering, though, since we have a few minutes, could we step out into the corridor for a word?
Sure, Clive. Let's do it now.
Royce told his associate to wait in the courtroom and retrieve us when the next group of defendants was brought into the glass cage. I followed Royce through the gate and down the aisle between the crowded rows of the gallery. We went through the man-trap and into the hallway.
"You want to get a cup of tea?" Royce asked.
"I don't think there's time. What's up, Clive?"
Royce folded his arms and got serious.
"I must tell you, Mick, that I am not out to embarrass you. You are a friend and a colleague in the defense bar. But you have gotten yourself into a no-win situation here, yes? What are we going to do about it?"
I smiled and glanced up and down the crowded hallway. Nobody was paying attention to us.
"Are you saying that your client wants to plead this out?"
"On the contrary, there will be no plea negotiation on this matter. The district attorney has made the wrong choice, and it's very clear what maneuver he is undertaking here and how he is using you as a pawn in the process. I must put you on notice that if you insist on taking Jason Jessup to trial, then you are going to embarrass yourself. As a professional courtesy, I just thought I needed to tell you this."
Before I could answer, Graydon came out of the courtroom and headed quickly toward us.
"Somebody in the first group is not ready, so Jessup's been moved up and was just brought out."
"We'll be in straight away," Royce said.
She hesitated and then realized her boss wanted her to go back into the courtroom. She went back through the doors and Royce turned his attention back to me. I spoke before he could.
"I appreciate your courtesy and concern, Clive. But if your client wants a trial, he'll get a trial. We'll be ready, and we'll see who gets embarrassed and who goes back to prison."
"Brilliant, then. I look forward to the contest."
I followed him back inside. Court was in session, and on my way down the aisle, I saw Lorna Taylor, my office manager and second ex-wife, sitting at the end of one of the crowded rows. I leaned over to whisper,
"Hey, what are you doing here?"
"I had to come see the big moment."
"How did you even know? I just found out 15 minutes ago."
"I guess so did KNX. I was already down here to look at office space, and I heard it on the radio that Jessup was going to appear in court, so I came."
"Well, thanks for being here, Lorna. How's the search going? I really need to get out of this building, soon."
"I have 3 more showings after this. That'll be enough. I'll let you know my final choices tomorrow, okay?"
"Yeah, that's..."
I heard Jessup's name called by the clerk.
"Look, I gotta get in there. We'll talk later."
"Go get him, Mickey."
I found an empty seat waiting for me next to Maggie at the prosecution table. Rivas had moved to the row of seats against the gate. Royce had moved to the glass cage where he was whispering to his client. Jessup was wearing an orange jumpsuit, the jail uniform, and looked calm and subdued. He was nodding to everything Royce whispered in his ear. He somehow seemed younger than I had thought he would. I guess I expected all of those years in prison to have taken their toll. I knew he was 48, but he looked no older than 40. He didn't even have a jailhouse pallor. His skin was pale, but it looked healthy, especially next to the overtanned Royce.
"Where did you go?" Maggie whispered to me. "I thought I was going to have to handle this myself."
"I was just outside conferring with defense counsel. Do you have the charges handy, in case I have to read them into the record?"
"You won't have to enter the charges. All you have to do is stand up and say that you believe Jessup is a flight risk and a danger to the community."
"But I don't believe he's a flight risk. His lawyer just told me that they're ready to go and that they're not interested in a disposition. He wants the money, and the only way he'll get it is to stick around and go to trial and win."
"So?"
She seemed astonished and looked down at the files stacked in front of her.
"Mags, your philosophy is to argue everything and give no quarter. I don't think that's going to work here. I have a strategy, and..."
She turned and leaned in closer to me.
"Then I'll just leave you and your strategy and your bald buddy from the defense bar to it."
She pushed back her chair and got up, grabbing her briefcase from the floor.
"Maggie!"
She charged through the gate and headed toward the rear door of the courtroom. I watched her go, knowing that while I didn't like the result, I had needed to set the lines of our prosecutorial relationship. Jessup's name was called, and Royce identified himself for the record.
I then stood up and said the words I never expected I would say. Michael Haller, for the people. Even Judge Firestone looked up from his perch, peering at me over a pair of reading glasses. Probably for the first time in weeks, something out of the ordinary had occurred in his courtroom. A dyed-in-the-wool defense attorney had stood for the people.
Well, gentlemen, this is an arraignment court, and I have a note here saying you want to talk about bail.
Jessup was charged 24 years ago with murder and abduction. When the Supreme Court reversed his conviction, it did not throw out the charges. That had been left to the DA's office. So he still stood accused of the crimes, and his not guilty plea of 24 years ago remained in place. The case now had to be assigned to a courtroom and a judge for trial. A motion to discuss bail would usually be delayed until that point, except that Jessup, through Royce, was pushing the issue forward by coming to Firestone.
Your Honor, Royce said, my client was already arraigned 24 years ago. What we would like to do today is discuss a motion for bail and to move this case along to trial. Mr. Jessup has waited a long time for his freedom and for justice. He has no intention of waiving his right to a speedy trial. I knew it was the move Royce would make, because it was the move I would have made. Every person accused of a crime is guaranteed a speedy trial. Most often trials are delayed at the defense's request or acquiescence, as both sides want time to prepare. As a pressure tactic, Royce was not going to suspend the speedy trial statute. With a case and evidence 24 years old, not to mention a primary witness whose whereabouts were at the moment unknown, it was not only prudent, but a no-brainer to put the prosecution on the clock. When the Supreme Court reversed the conviction, that clock started ticking. The people had 60 days from that point to bring Jessup to trial. 16 of them had already gone by.
I can move the case to the clerk for assignment, Firestone said, and I would prefer that the assigned judge handle the question of bail.
Royce composed his thoughts for a moment before responding. In doing so, he turned his body slightly so the cameras would have a better angle on him.
Your Honor, my client has been falsely incarcerated for 24 years, and those aren't just my words. That's the opinion of the state Supreme Court. Now they have pulled him out of prison and brought him down here so he can face trial once again. This is all part of an ongoing scheme that has nothing to do with justice and everything to do with money and politics. It's about avoiding responsibility for corruptly taking a man's freedom. To put this over until another hearing on another day would continue the travesty of justice that has beset Jason Jessup for more than 2 decades.
Very well.
Firestone seemed put out and annoyed. The assembly line had thrown a gear. He had a docket that had probably started with more than 75 names on it and a desire to get through them in time to get home for dinner before 8. Royce was going to slow things down immeasurably, with his request for a full debate on whether Jessup should be allowed his release while awaiting trial. But Firestone, like Royce, was about to get the surprise of the day. If he didn't make it home in time for dinner, it wouldn't be because of me. Royce asked the judge for an OR, meaning Jessup would have to put up no money as bail and simply be released on his own recognizance. This was just his opener. He fully expected there to be a financial figure attached to Jessup's freedom, if he was successful at all. Murder suspects didn't get OR'd. In the rare instance when bail was granted in a murder case, it usually came with a steep price tag. Whether Jessup could raise the money through his supporters or from the book and movie deals he was supposedly negotiating was not germane to the discussion. Royce closed his request by arguing that Jessup should not be considered a flight risk for the very same reason I had outlined to Maggie. He had no interest in running. His only interest was in fighting to clear his name after 24 years of wrongful imprisonment. Mr. Jessup has no other purpose at this time than to stay put and prove once and for all that he is innocent and that he has paid a nightmarish price for the mistakes and misconduct of this district attorney's office. The whole time Royce spoke, I watched Jessup in the glass cage. He knew the cameras were on him, and he maintained a pose of rightful indignation.
Despite his efforts, he could not disguise the anger and hate in his eyes. 24 years in prison had made that permanent. Firestone finished writing a note and then asked for my response. I stood and waited until the judge looked up at me.
"Go ahead, Mr. Haller," he prompted.
"Judge, providing that Mr. Jessup can show documentation of residence, the state does not oppose bail at this time." Firestone stared at me for a long moment as he computed that my response was diametrically opposite to what he thought it would be. The hushed sounds of the courtroom seemed to get even lower as the impact of my response was understood by every lawyer in the room.
"Did I get that right, Mr. Haller?" Firestone said. "You are not objecting to an OR release in a murder case."
"That is correct, Your Honor. We are fully expecting Mr. Jessup to show for trial. There's no money in it for him if he doesn't."
"Your Honor," Royce cried, "I object to Mr. Haller infecting the record with such prejudicial pap directed solely at the media in attendance. My client has no other purpose at this point than—"
"I understand, Mr. Royce," Firestone interjected. "But I think you did a fair amount of playing to the cameras yourself. Let's just leave it at that. Without objection from the prosecution, I am releasing Mr. Jessup on his own recognizance once he provides the clerk with documentation of residence. Mr. Jessup is not to leave Los Angeles County without permission of the court to which his case is assigned."
Firestone then referred the case to the clerk of the court's office for reassignment to another department for trial. We were now finally out of Judge Firestone's orbit. He could restart the assembly line and get home for dinner. I picked up the files Maggie had left behind and left the table. Royce was back at the seat at the railing, dumping files into a leather briefcase. His young associate was helping him.
"How did it feel, Mick?" he asked me.
"What, being a prosecutor?"
"Yes, crossing the aisle."
"Not too much different, to tell you the truth. It was all procedure today."
"You will be raked over the coals for letting my client walk out of here."
"Fuck him if they can't take a joke. Just make sure he stays clean, Clive. If he doesn't, then my ass really will be thrown on the fire. And so will his."
"No problem there. We'll take care of him. He's the least of your worries, you know."
"How's that, Clive?"
"You don't have much in the way of evidence. Can't find your main witness, and the DNA is a case killer. You're captain of the Titanic, Mickey, and Gabriel Williams put you there. Makes me wonder what he's got on you."
Out of all that he said, I only wondered about one thing. How did he know about the missing witness? I, of course, didn't ask him or respond to his jab about what the DA might have on me. I played it like all the overconfident prosecutors I had ever gone up against. "Tell your client to enjoy himself while he's out there, Clive, because as soon as the verdict comes in, he's going back inside." Royce smiled as he snapped his case closed. He changed the subject.
"When can we talk about discovery?"
"We can talk about it whenever you like. I'll start putting a file together in the morning."
"Good. Let's talk soon, Mick, yes?"
"Like I said, anytime, Clive." He headed over to the court deputy's desk, most likely to see about his client's release. I pushed through the gate and connected with Lorna, and we left the courtroom together. Waiting for me outside was a small gathering of reporters and cameras. The reporters shouted questions about my not objecting to bail, and I told them no comment and walked on by. They waited in place for Royce to come out next.
"I don't know, Mickey," Lorna confided. "How do you think the DA is going to respond to the no bail?"
Just as she asked it, my phone started beeping in my pocket. I realized I had forgotten to turn it off in the courtroom. That was an error that could have proven costly, depending on Firestone's view of electronic interruptions while court was in session. Looking at the screen, I said to Lorna, "I don't know, but I think I'm about to find out." I held up the phone so she could see that the caller ID said LADA.
"You take it. I'm gonna run. Be careful, Mickey."
She kissed me on the cheek and headed off to the elevator alcove. I connected to the call. I had guessed right. It was Gabriel Williams.
"Haller, what the hell are you doing?"
"What do you mean?"
"One of my people said you allowed Jessup to walk on an OR."
"That's right."
"Then I'll ask again. What the hell are you doing?"
Look, I...
No, you look. I don't know if you were just giving one of your buddies in the defense bar what he wanted, or you are just stupid, but you never let a murderer walk. You understand me? Now I want you to go back in there and ask for a new hearing on bail.
No, I'm not going to do that. There was a hard silence for at least 10 seconds before Williams came back.
Did I just hear you right, Holler?
I don't know what you heard, Williams, but I'm not going back for a rehearing. You have to understand something. You gave me a bag of shit for a case, and I have to do the best I can with it. What evidence we do have is 24 years old. We have a big hole blown in the side of the case with the DNA, and we have an eyewitness we can't find. So that tells me I have to do whatever I can do to make this case. And what's that got to do with letting this man out of jail?
Don't you see, man? Jessup has been in prison for 24 years. It was no finishing school. Whatever he was when he went in, he's worse now. If he's on the outside, he'll fuck up. And if he fucks up, that only helps us.
So in other words, you are putting the general public at risk while the guy is out there.
No, because you are going to talk to the LAPD and get them to watch this guy, so nobody gets hurt and they are able to step in and grab him the minute he acts out.
Another silence followed, but this time I could hear muffled voices, and I figured that Williams was talking it over with his advisor, Joe Riddle. When his voice came back to me, it was stern, but had lost the tone of outrage.
Okay, this is what I want you to do. When you want to make a move like this, you come to me first. You understand?
That's not going to happen.
You wanted an independent prosecutor. That's what you've got. Take it or leave it.
There was a pause, and then he hung up without further word. I closed my phone and watched for a few moments as Clive Royce exited the courtroom and waded into the crowd of reporters and cameras. Like a seasoned expert, he waited a moment for everyone to get their positions set and their lenses focused. He then proceeded with the first of what would be many impromptu but carefully scripted press briefings.
"I think the district attorney's office is running scared," he began.
It was what I knew he would say. I didn't need to listen to the rest. I walked away.
Chapter 8. Wednesday, February 17th, 9:48 a.m.
Some people don't want to be found. They take measures. They drag the branch behind them to confuse the trail. Some people are just running, and they don't care what they leave in their wake. What's important is that the past is behind them and that they keep moving away from it. Once he back-checked the DA investigator's work, it took Bosch only 2 hours to find a current name and address for their missing witness, Melissa Landy's older sister, Sarah. She hadn't dragged a branch. She had used the things that were close and just kept moving. The DA's investigator who lost the trail in San Francisco had not looked backwards for clues. That was his mistake. He had looked forward, and he'd found an empty trail. Bosch had started, as his predecessor had, typing the name Sarah Landy and birthdate April 14, 1972, into the computer. The department's various search engines provided myriad points of impact with law enforcement and society. First, there were arrests on drug charges in 1989 and 1990, handled discreetly and sympathetically by the Division of Children's Services. But she was beyond the reach and understanding of DYS for similar charges in late 1991 and two more times in 1992. There was probation and a period of rehabilitation, and this was followed by a few years during which she left no digital fingerprints at all. Another search site provided Bosch with a series of addresses for her in Los Angeles in the early 90s. Harry recognized these as marginal neighborhoods, where rents were probably low and drugs close by and easy to acquire. Sarah's illegal substance of choice was crystal meth, a drug that burned away brain cells by the billions. The trail on Sarah Landy, the girl who had hidden behind the bushes and watched her younger sister get taken by a killer, ended there.
Bosch opened the first file he had retrieved from the murder box and looked at the witness information sheet for Sarah. He found her social security number and fed that along with the DOB into the search engine. This gave him two new names, Sarah Edwards, beginning in 1991, and Sarah Witten in 1997. With women, changes of last names only were usually an indicator of marriage, and the DA's investigator had reported finding records of two marriages. Under the name Sarah Edwards, the arrests continued, including two pops for property crimes and a tag for soliciting for prostitution. But the arrests were spread far enough apart, and perhaps her story was sad enough, that once again she never saw any jail time. Bosch clicked through the mugshots for these arrests. They showed a young woman with changing hairstyles and colors, but the unwavering look of hurt and defiance in her eyes. One mugshot showed a deep purple bruise under her left eye and open sores along her jawline. The photos seemed to tell the story best, a downward spiral of drugs and crime, an internal wound that never healed, a guilt never assuaged. Under the name Sarah Witten, the arrests didn't change, only the location. She had probably realized she was wearing thin on the prosecutors and judges who had repeatedly given her breaks, most likely after reading the summary of her life contained in the pre-sentencing investigations. She moved north to San Francisco and once again had frequent encounters with the law. Drugs and petty crime, charges that often go hand in hand. Bosch checked the mugshots and saw a woman who looked old beyond her years. She looked like she was 40. Before she was yet 30. In 2003, she did her first significant jail time when she was sentenced to 6 months in San Mateo County Jail after pleading guilty to a possession charge. The records showed that she served 4 months in jail, followed by a lockdown rehab program. It was the last marker on the system for her. No one with any of her names or social security number had been arrested since or applied for a driver's license in any of the 50 states. Bosch tried a few other digital maneuvers he had learned while working in the open, unsolved unit, where internet tracing was raised to an art form, but could not pick up the trail. Sarah was gone. Putting the computer aside, Bosch took up the files from the murder box. He started scanning the documents, looking for clues that might help him track her. He got more than a clue when he found a photocopy of Sarah's birth certificate. It was then that he remembered that she had been living with her mother and stepfather at the time of her sister's murder. The birth name on the certificate was Sarah Ann Gleason. He entered it into the computer along with her birth date. He found no criminal history under the name, but he did find a Washington State driver's license that had been established 6 years earlier and renewed just 2 months before. He pulled up the photo, and it was a match, but barely. Bosch studied it for a long time. He would have sworn that Sarah Ann Gleason was getting younger. His guess was that she had left the hard life behind. She had found something that had made her change. Maybe she had taken the cure. Maybe she had a child. But something had changed her life for the better. Bosch next ran her name through another search engine and got utility and satellite hookups under her name. The addresses matched the one on her driver's license. Bosch was sure he had found her, Port Townsend. He went onto Google and typed it in. Soon he was looking at a map of the Olympic Peninsula in the northwest corner of Washington. Sarah Landy had changed her name 3 times and had run to the farthest tip of the continental United States, but he had found her. The phone rang as he was reaching for it. It was Lieutenant Stephen Wright, commander of the LAPD Special Investigation Section.
I just wanted you to know that as of 15 minutes ago, we're fully deployed on Jessup. The full unit's involved, and we'll get you surveillance logs each morning. If you need anything else or want to ride along at any point, you call me.
Thank you, Lieutenant. I will.
Let's hope something happens.
That would be nice.
Bosch disconnected and made the call to Maggie McPherson.
Couple things. First, SIS is in place now on Jessup. You can let Gabriel Williams know.
He thought he heard a small chuckle before she responded. Ironic, huh?
Yeah. Maybe they'll end up killing Jessup and we won't have to worry about a trial.
the Special Investigations Section was an elite surveillance squad that had existed for more than 40 years despite a kill rate higher than any other unit in the department, including SWAT. The SIS was used to clandestinely watch apex predators, individuals suspected in violent crimes who would not cease until caught in the act and stopped by the police. Masters of surveillance, SIS officers waited to observe suspects committing new crimes before moving in to make arrests, often with fatal consequences. The irony McPherson mentioned was that Gabriel Williams was a civil rights attorney before running for and winning the DA's post. He had sued the department over SIS shootings on multiple occasions, claiming that the unit's strategies were designed to draw suspects into deadly confrontations with police. He had gone so far as to call the unit a death squad while announcing a lawsuit over an SIS shooting that had left four robbers dead outside of Tommy's fast food franchise. That same death squad was now being used in a gambit that might help win the case against Jessup and further Williams' political rise. "You'll be informed of his activities?" McPherson asked.
"Every morning I'll get the surveillance log, and they'll call me out if anything good happens."
"Perfect. Was there something else? I'm in a bit of a rush. I'm working on one of my pre-existing cases and have a hearing about to start."
"Yeah, I found our witness."
"You're brilliant. Where is she?"
"Up in Washington, on the northern tip of the Olympic Peninsula, a place called Port Townsend. She's using her birth name, Sarah Ann Gleason, and it appears that she's been living clean up there for about 6 years."
"That's good for us."
"Maybe not."
"How so?"
"It looks to me like most of her life has been spent trying to get away from what happened that Sunday in Hancock Park. If she's finally gotten past it and is living the clean life up there in Port Townsend, she might not be interested in picking at old scabs, if you know what I mean."
"Not even for her sister?"
"Maybe not. We're talking about 24 years ago."
McPherson was quiet for a long moment and then finally responded. "That's a cynical view of the world, Harry. When are you planning on going up there?"
"As soon as I can. But I have to make arrangements for my daughter. She stayed with a friend when I went up to get Jessup at San Quentin. It didn't turn out so good, now I have to hit the road again."
"Sorry to hear that. I want to go up with you."
"I think I can handle it."
"I know you can handle it, but it might be good to have a woman and a prosecutor with you. More and more, I think she's